What is up, True Crime World? You're listening to Luminol on the Wall. I'm Becky.
And I'm Bevy. And today's case is about a woman whose MO is to control her lovers with the use of manipulation and witchcraft for her ultimate goal of monetary gain, with a lot of bloodshed along the way. This is the case of Clarence Good. Listener's discretion is advised. Hey, Becky.
Hey, Bev.
And hello to everyone tuning into this week's episode of LOTWA.
Yes, all of our LOTWA friends.
And followers. Yes, this case is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to change it up a little bit, do things a little differently, because if you don't know, Becky writes all of our podcasts for us. Thank you, Rebecca.
Oh, you're welcome.
You do a great job.
Thank you.
I'm impressed all the time by how well you do. And sometimes I read them because
we like to change it up.
Yeah, like as we just said. And I think we're basically just going to talk about this case.
We're going to try to create a bit more of a dialogue.
Yeah.
Between us.
So
hopefully you're into that.
Hopefully you're into that.
Hopefully we're into that.
If not, I don't know what to say.
Sorry.
Go back to last week's episode.
Yeah, scratch this one out.
The last 40. and we'll never do it again. No, but. Okay, so let's get into it because today's case seems to have some
twists,
like to say the least.
Yeah, major twists, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. It will knock your socks off.
Yeah.
So. As it did mine when I read over it. I was like,
the whole time Bev's like, crap.
No. Shoot. Just like kept getting crazier as it went on. I truly did not suspect that this was going to go in this direction. So I can't wait to share it with you guys.
Hurrah.
Hurrah. Let's get it going. Okay. So today's case is about a young man named Clarence Good. He grew up in Brooklyn, New York with his family. And although Clarence was raised well, he started getting into trouble in his early teens. He was not doing well in school either, and his parents were concerned with his future if he continued on the path that he was going. So in the early 80s, when Clarence was just 14 years old, his parents decided to send him to Gaithersburg, Maryland, to live with his older cousin, Josephine Gray. His parents had hoped that a new environment would set him on a better trajectory in life. Now, at the time that Clarence was sent to live with Josephine, she was married to a man named Robert Gray. Josephine and Robert were a pretty good couple together. They had been together for well over a decade, and they both had had a good lengthy career in the public school system as custodians. The dynamic of their relationship was more that Josephine wore the pants.
Mm-hmm.
She tended to be a little bit controlling over Robert. And I think Robert was probably like the more passive person in that duo.
I could imagine that might be the only way their relationship could work. If you have one person who's a bit more controlling, imagine having two super controlling people.
Yeah, like you would definitely butt heads if both of you guys were controlling.
Yes.
So, yeah. Together, the two had 6 children.
It's a lot of kids.
Yeah, not all together, but Josephine had kids from previous relationships. But when they added Clarence to the mix, that would have been 7 in total. And when he moved into their home, the youngest child aside from Clarence, who was again 14 at the time, was 16. So a lot of the kids that Josephine and Robert had together weren't actually living at home at the time that Clarence moved in with them. When Clarence moved in with them, the couple welcomed him with open arms and they treated him as if he were one of their own children. The new environment that Clarence was in ended up being a positive change for him, just like his parents had hoped. and he started to progress in a positive direction. He was doing well in school and was keeping out of trouble, which is just exactly what his parents hoped for him.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think it's not always the case when people do send their kids away
that it goes so well.
Yeah. So lucky for the whole family that this was a positive experience.
Yes. Well, like as of right now, right? So it's good.
Yes.
As of now. So things kept going good for quite a while. But in the 1990s, Josephine and Robert's relationship became strained. And then the pair separated. Robert moved out of the family home and into a townhouse in Germantown, which is a decent ways away in a different county from where Josephine was living.
Yeah.
So not long after they split up, Josephine gets a new boyfriend named Andre Savoy, who was a fellow custodian. Just as Robert had been once upon a time, she really likes those custodians. There's something to be said about commonalities, bringing people together, you know, even if it is a work commonality, a career commonality.
Yeah, there is a lot to be said. You know, I've bonded at jobs over either like for my job or dislike.
That's true.
You know, and then you become really good work friends.
Yeah.
And then apparently you bang some of them.
Apparently.
I'm talking about the case, not personally.
Thanks for clearing that up. I honestly didn't think that, considering you've been in the same relationship since you were like literally
early 20s.
It's like the only relationship you've actually had, to be fair, which is very romantic and sweet. But I appreciate you clearing that up to me and everyone around here, just in case, you know. But yeah, I mean, it happens to the best of people, right?
You just never know when the love bug's gonna bite.
Yeah,
that's true. Or the bang bug's gonna bite.
The what bug?
Bang bug?
The bang bug? Oh my god, for some reason I was thinking of like a nasty germ bug because of
the custodial effect.
Yeah, yeah, I wasn't expecting you to say a bang bug because I've never heard that term before.
Well, why can't there be a bang bug if there's a love bug?
Yeah, no, totally true. Like you can have a bang
lust bug.
Look at that, Becky.
Mm.
Why did your just sound so naughty? I don't know. That was crazy. Mm.
I don't know. I was doing it because I thought it was clever.
Anyway. <All right>. No, but in all seriousness, Andre had actually been seeing Josephine around for many years at the school that they both had worked at. And he had eventually caught mad feelings for her. And they started getting really serious and quickly moved into a home together in Upper Marlboro. And after they move in together, Josephine does something that, I mean, from afar would look like she's just being, again, a very nice cousin to Clarence, because she invites him to move in with her and Andre. And at this time, Clarence is an adult.
Yeah, he's not a child anymore.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, she's being kind to her cousin. Sure.
Yeah, maybe still that motherly figure. Maybe he still needs guidance. Or
exactly.
He lived with them before.
Exactly. So it just kind of seems like they're all this kind of big, happy family in a sense. Josephine is with Andre, and Clarence then starts a relationship with somebody else. And in this relationship with this woman, Clarence has a baby boy. However, their relationship doesn't last long, and ultimately the child stays with the mom,
mm-hmm.
the woman that Clarence was seeing, the mother of his bebé. And even though the couple wasn't together, Clarence was a very proud dad. He wanted his son to have the best life possible. So he held down multiple jobs and went to school and vowed to always take care of his son.
Yeah, like his friend said, he was working like so hard to give his son the best possible life that he could give his child.
Yeah, like obviously cares about him very, very much.
Very dedicated father.
Which is so nice to hear. But unfortunately, all that changes on June 22nd of 1996. A 911 call comes into the Baltimore, Maryland Emergency Services about a suspicious abandoned vehicle on Baltimore's west side, which is an area riddled with drugs and crime, notoriously.
Mm-hmm.
And when police arrive at the car, they can smell something from a couple feet away. And it's one of those smells that in any true crime show you watch, like,
once you smell it, you know what it is.
Yeah, they know what it is. And of course, it's they know that the body's inside that vehicle that is decomposing.
Yes.
So when they open it up, they find a young adult male, and he's wrapped in a blanket, which, by the way, just kind of odd that this case has a male found wrapped up in a blanket, just like last week's episode had a male found wrapped up in something as well.
Yeah, when I was reading about that, I'm like, that's funny. How am I doing back-to-back researches of burritoed men?
Burritoed men. Like, it's so weird that is, like, a commonality between this week and last week's Latwa episode.
Right? Out of all the cases I could have chosen.
Right?
How?
So weird. So weird. So anyways, the cops are not surprised at finding a dead body in this area of town. Because in the West End of Baltimore, there was almost a murder a day in the 90s, which is just a crazy stat.
It's a, like, lot, right?
Holy shit.
I know. And that was mostly because it was so, as you said earlier, like, drug populated and crime ridden.
Yeah, exactly.
That always facilitates a bit more death and dangerous actions.
Yeah, obviously. There's a lot more motivation for crime or just, like, violence in general.
Exactly. So at this point, the police are like, oh, here's another one.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they're going into it thinking, right?
Makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
So they begin looking into what has happened with this body, because even though they're not shocked, they still have a job to do. And they noticed that the person inside was shot in the chest and back, and they found a bag of cocaine tucked inside of the man's underwear. Initially, they think the most obvious thing. Oh, is this a drug deal gone bad? Right? Obviously, you find a bag of cocaine. I mean, it's logical.
Yeah, that's probably your first thought.
Exactly.
Yes.
However, that still seemed weird for them, because if it was a drug deal gone bad, why would the person who committed the crime leave the drugs on the person if they were motivated to murder somebody because of a drug deal gone bad? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, why would they leave drugs behind?
Yeah, they, like, you'd think they would take it if that was the reason.
Yeah.
Like, no, you don't take my drugs from me. No, you're not going to pay me. What? Let me just leave this money basically on you.
Yeah, it turns into virtually a senseless crime at that point. I mean, as we always say, they're always all senseless.
But it's just, like, the motivation doesn't line up. Yeah,
does
it's,
not
like,
compute.
Confusing. Exactly. So they also notice that there's a distinct lack of blood in the car, which makes investigators begin thinking that this man was killed at a separate location and that the drugs were planted on him to create the certain narrative of a drug deal gone bad.
Right. That makes sense.
So detectives run the license plate of the car, and they find that it belongs to 28-year-old Clarence Good. And it would appear that Clarence was, in fact, the person that was found dead inside this vehicle. So obviously, at this point, since they've positively identified who is dead inside this vehicle, they begin to notify the friends and family of Clarence. And everyone is completely shocked, because Clarence was seen by his friends and family as someone who was very hardworking and a productive individual in society. And based on his lifestyle, it didn't really make sense to anyone that knew him that he would be found dead in the trunk of his car.
With drugs on his person.
Exactly, because he was not a drug dealer. He didn't even associate with drugs.
I can imagine his friends and family are just sitting there like, what the hell happened to him?
Well, exactly. Like,
he wouldn't be down in the West End for any reason.
Yeah, like, he didn't live down in the West End. He had zero reason to even be there at all.
Mm-hmm.
So learning that that's where he was found, and, like, with drugs in his underwear, no less, like, his friends and family are like, this doesn't make sense to anything we know about this man. So After speaking with some of his friends and families, the cops figure they have to go speak to someone that had been a constant in his life, which is none other than Josephine Gray. She obviously helped raise him, and she's very proud of the man that Clarence was becoming. And she said that she believed she had raised him right and believed that his experience with her set him on a positive path for the rest of his life, and appeared to be shocked and devastated with his death, and told investigators that she had no idea why anyone would want to kill him.
And right. So that this is like a common theme amongst all his loved ones.
Yes. Like,
it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense. So I'm sure the cops at this point are like, we have to continue digging into what could have actually happened, because what's at the surface just doesn't make sense. And obviously, when things just don't add up like that, there's things going on beneath that are like kind of convoluting what's being shown, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're going to look into this a little bit further. So they find out that although Josephine seemed like a mother figure to him, when they talked to some of Clarence's friends, they learned that Clarence and Josephine had actually had an inappropriate, incestual cousin-to-cousin relationship.
Ugh.
And his friends believed that around the age of 18, like, sorry, when Clarence was 18 is when this incestual relationship started and when they became lovers.
And on top of it, Bev, she was 20 years his senior.
Yeah, so it's like, not only is it incestual, which is, yeah, vomit worthy,
mm-hmm.
It is slightly predatory.
Yeah.
Am I wrong? Like, I mean, he's 18.
Well, if you think it's an adult. Like, if you think it started when he was 18, there was obviously a bit of grooming going on.
Yes, exactly.
And maybe a little flirting. Like, I don't know the specific details, but it's not right no matter which way you look at it.
And to be fair, like, she was his, like, mother figure at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this, like, power dynamic. Just based on that alone, the relationship is highly inappropriate. And then you add into the mix that he was a minor relying on her for his place of living, for his food, for his well-being at the time. That just adds an additional power imbalance with her holding the power that makes this relationship even more inappropriate.
Well, absolutely, because now, regardless if he was enjoying it, he is probably at some level concerned, well, if I don't enjoy it or I don't do what she says, I could lose all my essentials.
Yeah, there's a lot at stake fear. For him. So, yeah, it's bad whichever way you slice it. So his friends start questioning this relationship, and Clarence actually tells his friends that Josephine was his girlfriend. And as we said, Josephine is 20 years his senior. And at the time, his friends kind of poke fun that he's with an old lady, which, I mean, for kids that are the same age as him, I can see that being like what they make fun of him for. But from our perspective, we're like, holy shit, she is like a predator on this young man who thinks that his cousin and an older lady is his girlfriend. So as we've articulated, Josephine, just based on the nature of their relationship, was in a power position over Clarence, and she was able to manipulate him into doing what she wanted in that relationship. Plus, we know that she's already kind of a controlling person in previous relationships, like with Robert, she wore the pants. And because of that, it was said that Clarence would basically do anything for her. And through the investigators' investigation, they also find out that Robert had found out about the relationship between Josephine and Clarence, and this is actually what led to the split between Robert and Josephine.
Yeah, it's not like they just grew apart, but could you imagine finding that out?
No, I'd be like, holy crap, like, who am I married to?
Yeah, like an affair, never good.
But an affair with, like,
incestual tendencies?
Even more crazy.
Grody.
And so when Robert left Josephine, they had been married at that point for 15 years, which is a long time for a marriage, and crazy that it broke up in that way. And it was also said and noted that during this time before the breakup, Josephine started acting differently towards Robert. Her demeanor completely changed. She had become hostile towards him. And that's actually a part of what led Robert to leave her, on top of finding out about what he did. So their relationship just kind of like took a turn for the worse. Plus, a bomb was dropped and they split. What is even more wild to me is that Clarence's and Josephine's relationship and affair continued on even when Josephine was dating and living with Andre Savoy.
And Clarence was living with them at the time as well.
So now it makes sense why Josephine wanted Clarence to live with them.
Yeah, she wants her little, like, toy.
She wants her cake and she wants to eat it too, Becky. So now we're wondering, like, is this whole relationship between Josephine and Clarence a reason as to why he was found dead?
Yeah, the investigators must be wondering, could Andre or Robert have killed Clarence in pure vengeance?
Exactly, for sleeping with their woman, right? Exactly.
It's a possibility. So
the investigators then speak to Andre and confront him about this affair that Josephine was having. And in a very surprising turn of events, he seems oddly okay with their relationship. Andre just said he wanted to be with Josephine no matter what that looked like, and was absolutely dedicated to her. Because as we know, he had been, like, eyeing her down for a long time, was infatuated with her, right?
Yes.
So Andre tells investigators another little tidbit that Clarence was the one who seemed to have a problem with Andre and Josephine's relationship.
Well, I could imagine that, Bev, because here's this young guy, super impressionable, falling in love with his cousin, but from a young age, and he develops feelings, emotions, they have a sexual connection, all that stuff. And now he thinks maybe that Josephine is all his, but then she brings another man into the mix.
Exactly. Obviously, she knows what she's doing is wrong, because she's not willing to fully commit to Clarence.
Yeah. Doesn't but she's not willing to let him go either.
Exactly.
Ugh, this so lady.
Andre tells investigators that one night, Clarence heard Andre and Josephine having sex. He became enraged. He stormed through the house, smashing things, and tried to get into the bedroom. He tried to bang down the door, but Josephine ends up having to go into the bathroom and crawl out the window to get outside.
She's like, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm done with this. And her leaving apparently seemed to calm Clarence down. But he was so angry with the situation that he ended up leaving and moving in with his sister in Baltimore shortly after.
He had had enough.
Yeah, which, no kidding.
Yeah.
However, despite Clarence being angry and moving out, every time he would try and leave the situation, Josephine would call him. And of course, due to, like, her manipulation over him, he was at her beck and call. He would keep coming back. And Clarence's friends had told investigators that they felt that he was somehow under Josephine's spell, which, again, just proves the inappropriate power imbalance in their relationship.
Exactly. Like, he just couldn't not be around her.
Exactly. It was said that Clarence recognized that he should get away from Josephine, but he just couldn't. And they continued their relationship. Throughout all of this, the investigators really feel that Andre is being very forthcoming And it just didn't seem like he was the type of person that could have done this to Clarence. So they truly felt that he was being honest. However, they ended up becoming pretty suspicious of Miss Josephine after talking to Andre. So they decide to look into her past. So let's get into her past. Josephine was born in 1946 in Montgomery County, just west of Baltimore, Maryland. She lived there most of her life. It was said that she was a very beautiful woman, and people said she would have men eating from the palm of her hand, which, just from what we've heard, correct. Seems true. So she seemed to have settled down and done the conventional thing. You know, she got a job, she got married, she had children. But when investigators start really digging into her past and they speak to the police in Montgomery County, they learn that she has had other lovers, specifically husbands, that have turned up dead over the years. So in 1974, Josephine was married to her first husband, Norman Stribling. They grew up together in Montgomery County and eventually fell in love. They got married and had 5 children together. And after about 10 years together, their relationship became rather strained because Norman found out that Josephine was having an affair with Robert Gray. And on top of that, Norman told friends and family at the time that he was actually very fearful of Josephine. And the turning point for him was that one night he awoke to Josephine standing over him in bed with a gun pointed at his head. And he had told friends and family, you know, I have to get away from her. It was at that point that he made the decision to move in with his aunt and family members. But only a month after he had moved out from Josephine and his family's home, Norman was found dead in a car. The vehicle was found pulled off on the side of the road in a rural area with no houses around. He had a gun wound to his right temple from a .32 caliber revolver. The driver's side window was down, and there were cigarette butts and footprints on the outside of the car. Detectives believe that Norman knew his killer and believed the mission was to kill Norman, just based on the evidence that was found at the scene.
Right, like it wasn't an accident or...
Yeah, it was an execution.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. I mean, a gunshot to the head, an right abandoned to the temple, car. Yep. Yeah, makes sense.
Yes.
So almost immediately, detectives started suspecting Josephine. And they also believed that she had potentially manipulated her lover, Robert Gray, into helping her execute the murder of Norman. The reason that they thought this was that through their investigation, they had found that Robert actually owned a .32 caliber revolver that he had kept at his parents' house. The detectives had also met with Josephine's brother and cousin, who told investigators that nights before Norman's murder, Josephine and Robert had met them at a nightclub in D.C., offering them $10,000 to kill Norman. And at that time, Josephine and Robert were arrested for solicitation to commit murder. However, just before the trial was set to begin, Josephine's relatives, who had told the investigators that they were solicited to commit murder, all of a sudden disappeared. And because their case was highly circumstantial and relied on the testimony of Josephine's family, they really had not much to go on. So eventually, the charges were dropped. However, when her cousin and brother turned up again, they denied their initial statement to the detectives, and so they still had nothing to go on. So Robert and Josephine were never charged for Norman's murder.
Yeah, they just were able to kind of walk away from it.
Yeah, which is crazy. So, like, that is actually crazy. I wonder, in all of this, if Josephine, like, threatened her family members. You say nothing.
I mean, her husband was fearful of her. Imagine if she could put that much fear that he would move out of the family home. Imagine what she could do to other family members.
Exactly. And not only that, but he was found dead. So, like,
they're like, family ooh, members I don't had want real to die reason, now.
Yeah, to disappear and just recant what they had said.
Right. Especially the brother and cousin, because, like you said, he's wound up dead. They're like, we don't want to meet that same fate.
Exactly.
We're not saying shit.
I know, and I don't blame them.
Yeah.
Because I would, too, be scared. Especially, they don't know that Josephine killed Norman, but, like, you know, they have to be thinking it.
They're all highly suspicious, I'm sure.
Exactly. And not long after Norman was killed, Robert and Josephine were married. And they received a $16,000 life insurance policy for Norman's death, which is just so shitty. Like, they're the number one suspect in his murder. No one can prove it. And they get paid out
his life insurance
regardless because she was his wife. So they use that money to put a down payment on a new house. And throughout all of this, Robert's family is actually really concerned with this relationship because just after they got married, Robert stopped coming around. They felt that Josephine was the cause of this. She seemed to have ultimate control over their life together. She had control of the finances, what they were doing each day, and they felt that he was strongly manipulated and controlled by his new wife, and they disliked that. And I think it's a common trait of, like, abusers that they isolate them from their family members. And I'm not saying that's exactly what was going on, but, you know, with her history and everything, it doesn't seem out of the question that this is kind of something that is going on in their relationship and is obviously what his family is kind of worried about, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure she's not just doing it by accident. Like, you don't typically have control and not allow your spouse to see someone if it's not at least one of your tactics, whether you're abusive or not, right?
Yeah, it definitely seems like an intentional tactic of hers, whether she's an abuser or not. I totally agree with you. So we are now at the point where you and I and everyone listening knows that Robert and Josephine's relationship after 15 years completely dissolves. The cracks start to show. She's having an affair with her cousin. Like, we know the outcome of this.
Yes.
But what we don't know yet and what investigators find out is that Robert was actually scared of his wife as well. His coworkers realized he was on edge and he starts behaving like a man that was terrified of his wife. And all of his friends and family knew this. And now investigators, we know it, and everyone listening knows it too. So she strikes fear in the people that she's in a close relationship with, which is scary in and of itself. Like, yes, to be fearful of your intimate partner, that's not good.
And assuming that Robert also, keep in mind, he knows what she did or maybe what they did to her Norman. First husband, right?
Yes, Becky.
So he's probably like, ultra scared because he's like, I know what she's capable of.
Yeah. So as soon as, like, the cracks start showing in their relationship, he's like, oh my God.
Am I next?
My life is at risk.
Yeah. He's genuinely fearful.
Wow. That is, I didn't even think of that, but I'm thankful you mentioned it because holy crap, that's probably exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
So now in August of 1990, Robert Gray's stepson, Bernard Stribling, which, if we remember the last name, that is Norman's son, yes, right? Because she had five kids with Norman, yeah, and Robert acted as a father to them.
Father to them, yeah.
So he goes to police headquarters wanting to talk to an investigator because he said he had knowledge of a crime that was going to happen, which, dun, 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 with everything you just said, that statement is hella ominous, Beck.
And it's their children. Like, their child is coming forward. Like, what a shitty position for that guy to be in.
No kidding.
Like, their child. Like, could you imagine hearing something that's going to happen that involves your parents?
Yes.
I mean, like, what do? Go to the cops? Yes. Shit.
But still shitty.
Yeah.
So he tells investigators that his mother killed his father and was never convicted. And now the way she was acting, he knew that she was going to kill his stepfather, Robert. Unfortunately, Bernard's fears become a reality because on October 5th, Robert had reported that Josephine had threatened him with a club and a knife. And not long after that, he was driving and he notices Josephine behind him. She's flashing her headlights, trying to signal for his attention and to pull over. So he did, which is like, fuck, why? But anyways, Josephine pulled up beside him. She leaned back and all of a sudden, Clarence leaned forward and pointed a gun at him. He didn't shoot him, but Robert felt very threatened by this act, he should.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to the police and presses charges against Josephine. And just a week before he was set to testify against her, on November 9th of 1990, Robert's daughter found him laying dead on his apartment floor. it was very clear that he had been shot in the neck and the chest with a .45 caliber handgun. It looked to detectives that there wasn't any forced entry, so they believed that whoever had done this had a key to his house. Based on what they saw, it looked like Robert had gotten home, placed his newly bought case of beer on the table, took his jacket off when someone shot him as he was walking down the hall. They believed someone was lying in wait for him. Investigators had spoken to Clarence, and he said he had no involvement or knowledge of this crime. He told investigators that he had gone to pick up Josephine from work so that she could drive him to his job, and that that was all he knew. The investigators then got a search warrant for Josephine's home, and the only thing that they were able to find was a handful of .45 caliber bullets in a purse in her basement.
And quite literally, that's all they found.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty damning in and of itself, though.
And also not a lot, all in one swoop.
That's true. And to add to your point, it's quite unfortunate because there was no way that they were able to match them to the ammunition in Robert's case. So at that point, they only had circumstantial evidence. And same as Norman's case, the witnesses were hard to come by and there wasn't anyone talking if they did know anything. So they had no case against her.
Man, she must be sitting there thinking that she is the smartest woman on earth.
Yeah, because if she is the one who is responsible for both these deaths, she has completely gotten away with it at this point.
Yeah, the police are hung up on just really low-level circumstantial evidence, which we know that's not enough to take someone to trial for murder because they're most likely going to get off on that and then you'll never be able to charge them again.
Yeah, so it's something that they wouldn't even want to risk, especially if they have high suspicions of her doing it. Like, if you bring someone to trial, you want them to get put away in jail.
So you
want to
make damn sure that you got that freaking evidence.
Exactly. So as they're looking into this, they find that outwardly, Josephine has a really pleasant and cheery demeanor. But the reason why people were so scared of her was that she was heavily involved in witchcraft and voodoo. And at times, she used that to control and threaten the people around her. They were completely horrified that if they spoke out against Josephine, that they would have spells and hexes put upon them. So because of these factors, detectives hit a dead end. They had no direction to go in because no one would speak up. So in a last-ditch effort, they applied a bug to Josephine's house. And just by chance, and probably the copious amount of circumstantial evidence, this got approved.
Yes, it did.
And what the detectives end up hearing in these tapes was fucking creepy. The lead detective heard Josephine, her daughter, and Clarence having a voodoo session where they cast a spell on the lead detective in this case. But outside of that, they didn't hear anything that was incriminating to the murder. So unfortunately, at the end of the day, they had to drop the charges against Josephine in regards to Robert's death. Now, because the charges were dropped, Josephine actually receives $50,000 in life insurance from Robert's policy.
Yeah, you know the worst part about it, Bev? Robert what? Was unaware.
That he had a life insurance policy?
Yeah, she took it out on him.
Wow, and then he winds up dead and she gets yet another payout.
Yep.
Which is just sick. So what's even more twisted about it all, not like on top of the fact that this is her second payout, is what she uses the money for. She yet again uses the money to move herself and Clarence into a brand new home, which if you remember, that's what her and Robert had done when they received the life insurance policy from Norman, put it on a down payment for a new home.
Yep.
It's like the same old story with her. Like, get some new material.
I know. Like, talk about MO.
No kidding. So at that point, everyone had kind of thought that she was just moving forward with Clarence. But she was actually moving forward and in a relationship with Andre Savoy, and Clarence was just living with them. And what is really odd and just again speaks to her MO is that it was only 5 years after this that Clarence was found dead in his car. So now after the detectives who are looking into Clarence's murder kind of learn all of this background about Josephine and her diabolical history, the Baltimore PD realize that they are looking into the same lady for Clarence's death that the Montgomery County are looking into for the deaths of Norman and Robert. So they decide to work together.
Yeah, they want to catch her.
Exactly. So with all of the circumstantial evidence that the two police forces have combined, they're actually able to get a search warrant for Josephine's home. And in their search, they find that in the garage, there is a bunch of red splatter. It was tested and it was determined that it was human blood. So they sent it off to get tested. While waiting for those results, detectives get a search warrant to check Josephine's phone. And they realize that the evening that Clarence died, she had actually called Clarence through his pager. There was also a unique phone number that called Josephine's home phone. When that was tracked, it came from a payphone outside of a pharmacy just around the corner from Josephine's house. And when detectives contact the pharmacy, they learned that Clarence was actually sick and needed meds, and that he filled that prescription at the pharmacy around the corner from Josephine's house because Clarence had called Josephine from that number. And because of her stronghold that she had over him, detectives assumed that he was actually meeting up with her.
That would only make sense because why else would he call her? And why else would he get his prescription filled there?
Exactly.
It's like, out of the way for him.
Yes, and because of the timing of it all, they believed that Josephine was involved in Clarence's murder somehow. And what the detectives think happened that night was that Clarence had showed up at Josephine's house, and at the time that he turned around to leave her home, she shot him. They assumed this because of the blood splatter on the walls and just like the angle of it. They just assumed that that is what happened. They thought that after she shot him, she put his body into his own car and drove it to Baltimore's West End to make it look like a drug deal gone bad. And when they get the lab tests back from the blood splatter in Josephine's garage, it was determined that there wasn't actually enough to get a clear DNA sample, which is par for the course. I mean, like, every time she just seems to, like, do enough to kind of not get concrete evidence against her.
Yeah, for like the third time in a row, they are running into the exact same problem.
They think it's her.
Yeah, but they have no hard evidence to prove it in the court of law.
Exactly. And what is just like, honestly, I'm laughing, but it's also pretty fucking sad, but it's just mind-boggling. They also learn that Josephine gets a life insurance policy of $100,000 from Clarence.
Yeah, that is insane, isn't it? And again, Bev, he had no idea that he had that life insurance policy on him.
This is like, she is just a greedy bitch right now.
Yeah, she is.
Is she going to buy a home with it? Like,
most likely.
Right?
Like, just a bigger one.
A bigger one, yeah. With another boyfriend, maybe Andre Savoy. And watch your back, Andre, because
you probably next, man.
Yeah, unless the cops can figure this case out, like, watch your back.
It's not sounding promising. So hopefully he has his, like, blinkers on, his radar.
His radar being like, I'm next. In bed with a murderer.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Watch your
back. Do I have a life insurance policy against me? Probably.
Yeah. Not one I know of.
So, like, the detectives are just scratching their head. They're like, how can we get this murderer off the streets? So they decide to find something that will actually stick. They don't care at this point what the charge is.
They just want her off the streets.
Exactly. And when they start looking at all of the deep details of these murders, they realize that Josephine had taken out life insurance policies on all three with the anticipation that they would die and that she would profit from that, which we have already stated. But fortunately for detectives, there is this thing called Slayer's Rule. And it means that if you are involved in any way in someone's murder, you cannot profit from it. And they know that this is what she did. So what they do is they charge her with 8 counts of wire and mail fraud because she used the mail and telephone to claim the insurance. And in 2002, Josephine Gray is officially charged with 8 counts of wire and mail fraud, and her trial begins in July of 2002. Prosecutors argue that she was able to use Robert to kill Norman and then use Clarence to scare and or kill Robert. And as we said before, the detectives don't suspect Andre, but he is scared to testify. So they need a little something to incentivize Andre to talk on the stand. They find out that Josephine has actually taken out a life insurance policy on him, which
we can only assume he was next.
He was not aware of it.
Oh, poor guy.
Oh, my God. I will have to say, I did skim over your script here, Bex, but I didn't get this far. And it's just so funny that I had literally just said, does he have a life insurance policy on him? Like, maybe check that out.
Yeah, I'm sitting here like, yeah, he does.
Find out.
Sure shit does.
He sure as shit does. So this is the light bulb moment for Andre. He starts thinking, could he be next?
Yeah, he's thinking what we're thinking.
Of course.
Is his life in danger? The answer, sir, is yes. It Most is only definitely. A matter of time.
This girl don't change her stripes.
Yeah.
So because of this, he agrees to testify. And what is amazing is that Andre was a really great witness because Josephine had actually confided in him to what she had done in regards to her past lovers. So he was a really important witness because he basically kind of gives insight into the murders.
Yeah.
Not only like the mail and wire fraud, but the actual murders. The exact thing that the detectives had wanted all along. So during her trial, after hearing this, Josephine's defense lawyers tried to argue that she should not be convicted of anything now because she was not found guilty in any other cases.
Yeah, like because the last time that she was even remotely brought to trial or almost brought to trial, they had no witnesses. They had no hard evidence. Therefore, they couldn't even charge her
with anything. With
the murder. So if they had nothing to charge her with, why should she even be convicted of mail and wire fraud?
Well, because now they have a great witness. Hello, Mr. Andre Savoy.
That's right.
Like, nice try, defense lawyers, but
no bueno.
No bueno. So in December of 2002, after a long, long trial, the jury reached a verdict and they found her guilty on all 8 wire and mail fraud charges. Every charge that she was found guilty of was 5 years in jail. So she was sentenced to 40 years in jail for fraud. And at the time of her trial, Josephine was in her 50s. So this was virtually a life sentence for her.
Yeah, that's 40 years in prison.
Yeah, like she'll be 90 before she gets out. I mean, listen, do I think that this is justice served? No, I don't at all.
But as we know, though, a life sentence is 25 years
to life.
To life.
So 40 years is
longer.
It is longer. So, but
she could have potentially applied for parole after 25 years and maybe gotten out.
It's but
this
true.
Almost secures her in jail for 40 years.
That is true. This is like a silver lining, right? There is a silver lining. It's not like justice wasn't completely served, but I just don't think it's justice for the men who were murdered.
Yeah, because she wasn't actually charged
with murder
and found guilty of that.
Yeah.
But so, based on the circumstances, considering they didn't have enough evidence to really bring like a formal murder charge,
this was amazing.
Best case scenario.
Totally, Becky. And I'm happy that at least they got her on something.
Yeah.
Because she definitely deserves to be in prison.
Oh, yeah. She's terrible.
She's a terrible person right now. So more recently, in Josephine's 70s, her defense attorneys requested that she be released due to medical concerns. However, that request was denied, and she's going to stay in prison.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. I mean, I'm just happy that she was put away and that she's doing her time and she is held accountable for her terrible choices. But damn.
What a psycho.
What a psycho.
And thank God they caught her like when they did, because Andre could have been next. Like,
he
they
would
most
have been.
Likely
he
prevented a fourth been. Death.
Yes, 100%. And It's like, what was her real motivation? Was it greed, Becky?
Yeah, I don't know.
It must have been, right? Like, she got her payouts. It must have been.
That's the only thing I can think of. I mean, also, when we look back, like, Robert knew about the first murder. Clarence most likely knew about the second. So there was that on top of the financial motivation, like, to have them be silenced, right?
Right.
Because they were all bringing charges against her at some point.
That's a great point, Becky. She was basically motivated by silencing people and making money, which, again, speaks to, like, her need for control.
And horrible character.
So, Becky, this was the case of Josephine Gray, and I wish the best for all of the men's families that had to kind of be left in the wake of her crappy decisions.
And anyone who doesn't know if they have life insurance, look into it.
Yeah, look into it.
You just never know.
Yeah, you never know who's being fraudulent behind your back and taking advantage of you as a human being.
That's right. So be safe out there.
Be safe. Anyways, Bex, thanks for joining me in this journey.
Absolutely. Well, Bev, thanks for sharing.
Thanks for listening.